Steve, you want to come back up here?
We'll sure.
Got some questions for you. The first question comes from Chris at table number 5. When do you decide to press in on an interview when you hear inaccurate information?
Wow, thank you for that question. I would like to say always and all the time. And that is generally true. I want to be ready when someone says something that I know is false or that I don't know, like they cite a statistic I've never heard before. I want to be ready either to call that out, to say there's a different viewpoint on it, or to say, haven't heard that stat before, we'll check up on it. It is especially challenging in a live interview to do that sort of thing, because some guests will show up with, you know, canned information, talking points, things they want to throw out there, and it might be blatantly false or just a point of view that I think needs to be put in wider context. And I try to push back all the time. There is sometimes a challenge in a live interview with someone who says 5 dubious things in a row. And then you have to decide, which of these 5 things do I push back on? And sometimes there are things that are just kind of rhetorical hyperbole in that situation. I'll let it go, but I want to push back on the thing that is most vital. I would not like anybody to say anything false on our air, or if they do, I mean, you're allowed to say what you want to say. I want to put it in context and push back in such a way that the audience understands that something dubious or false has just been said. So all the time that time allows, I'll push back.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Fred at table number 30. If you hadn't been a radio journalist, what do you think you would have done and been good at it?
That's such a short list. If I hadn't been a radio journalist, wow. Well, when I was a kid, I was from Indiana. David Letterman was from Indiana. I thought, oh, I could do that job. I couldn't have done that job. I have ended up being a writer primarily of history, and maybe I could have been a writer in the same way, but I'm not sure that I would have learned the right things. The lessons that I've learned through thousands of interviews have informed the way that I write about the past and have informed the way that I think about the past. And I'll also say the reverse. Writing about the past informs the way that I talk about the present all the time on the radio. But it could very well be that I would have ended up in one of the jobs that I had before I worked in radio. I remember working at a car wash, but I was terrible. And I remember working for the Census Bureau for $7 an hour. That was a good job.
Our next question is from Murphy at table number 17. Hey, Murphy. It is a tradition for us to ask our esteemed guests this serious question of character. Which superpower would you choose if given the choice between flight or invisibility? Please explain.
I have an answer to that. I would choose flight. All right. Because I love to see things, and you can see things from above, and that sounds rather exciting. Invisibility, I don't think is something that I'm comfortable with. And I actually have a specific... But you go overseas to dangerous places, right? I mean, when you're a journalist, sometimes you get sent to Iraq, as I've been, or Syria. And you want to be low profile and not call attention to yourself, but I've only been able to take that so far. I don't want to shock you, but when I go to another country, it's pretty obvious that I'm an American. I have a colleague, a dear friend of mine, who did a lot more time in Iraq than I did and began to be uncomfortable there because foreigners were being targeted, of course. And it was a particular problem for him because he looked like Brad Pitt. And so he began taking a number of steps. He began dressing in Iraqi clothes. So then he looked like Brad Pitt in Iraqi clothes. And then he grew a beard and became Brad Pitt with a beard and wore a headscarf. Brad Pitt with a beard and a headscarf. I have known journalists who've been Americans who've claimed to be Canadian or claimed to be French or whatever, just to kind of reduce the chance of someone targeting them as an American. I've never been able to bring myself to do that. I've never wanted to do that. If anybody asks who I am anywhere in the world, I say I'm an American, and I'm proud of it, and I'll stand for it. And I will say also, various uncomfortable things have happened to me overseas, but here I still am standing, so it's worked okay.
Our next question is from Ned. Hey Ned, at table 28. Could you please give an example of how the pre-Civil War political discourse is familiar to today's?
Wow, someone is familiar what I write, because I've been writing about before the Civil War, and of course I just alluded to that in the speech, I guess. There was a debate as early as the 1820s over Georgia's effort to remove Creek and Cherokee Indians from what Georgia claimed as its land. Legally, it was their land, but the state of Georgia had its own competing claim. And they began to assert their claim to this land to sign bogus treaties with renegade factions of Indian leaders, and to simply take over Indian land, and framed all of this as a matter of state rights and of local government, and of something that they had a right to do, and nobody else had a business to do, had a business to interfere with it. And when you look at the language that was used to defend that action, there's also a lot of talk about elites in Washington and unelected judges and things that people say today on entirely different issues in an entirely different context. And you see in that example, and I could go through and give you a bunch of others, debates about essentially our federal structure. Who has what power at what level, and what takes precedence? What is more important, the state's rights, basic human rights? What are the national rules that we all must follow? What are the state rules that we want to follow at the local level? We have a debate today, essentially, over the Electoral College. There might even be one or two people in this room who are upset that the winner of the popular vote is not president today. But it happens sometimes in our system, and people have raised questions like, why is it that California and Oklahoma each have two senators when California has something like 10 times the population of Oklahoma? How is that democracy? How is that fair? And of course, what it is the rules under which we've always played, and we could have a debate over whether those rules could change, but those are the rules, and they're there for a reason. People had a very similar debate before the Civil War. There was a certain number of slave states, a certain number of free states, and it was very important to people in the South and some people in the North that they remain about the same number of states. And one of the things that ultimately caused the Civil War is that the North grew much larger and more populous, had more electoral votes, and a moment arrived when it seemed possible for the North to elect a president on its own without the participation of the South. And the South had to decide how they felt about that. And we know how the South decided that they felt about that and how that was expressed at the time. I don't mean to say that our debates today are identical to then. I mean to say that it is instructive to see that we've had some of the same arguments going on and on and on, and variations on those arguments for a couple hundred years, and on some level, that's okay. It's okay that we're having that fight and we have that continuous debate about what is right and what is wrong and what are the rules under which we play.
Our next question is from Patricia at table number 28. Patricia, 2019-20 is the centennial of women's suffrage. How does NPR plan to cover this story?
I don't know. I actually don't know what our coverage plans are, but it's a fantastic question. It's a fantastic subject. The book that I'm finishing now that comes out in January is about two people, John C. Fremont, the Western explorer, and his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, who who was the daughter of a senator and the smarter of the two. And he was, and I bring this up, it's relevant, it really is relevant to the question. In the absence of an actual answer, I'm giving you something, because I don't know the answer to your question. John C. Fremont was a Western explorer who went out and explored the West and participated in the American conquest of California. But as explorers go, he didn't really discover very much that was new. His genius was, after having his interesting adventures, he went back to Washington where he lived and wrote best-selling books about his adventures and became hugely famous, one of the most famous people in the 19th century. His wife, although much younger, was his secretary, sometimes editor, sometimes co-author, sometimes ghostwriter, political advisor, and in many ways a better half for real. Jessie Benton Fremont was extraordinarily influential and ultimately became very famous herself. She became famous because John C. Fremont was the first ever Republican candidate for president in 1856. And he was nominated at this time when women's rights were building up and women were getting all excited about the possibility of participating in politics. And even though they did not have the right to vote, many were active in the anti-slavery movement and participated in the Republican Party. And they took on Jessie Benton Fremont as a symbol. And she became hugely famous, as her husband was. Now, she became hugely famous even though she had not particularly campaigned for the right for women to vote. And some years after that presidential campaign, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who as many of you all know is one of the founding women of the women's rights movement as we know it, came to Jessie Benton Fremont and said, "Can you make a contribution to the women's suffrage movement?" I mean, maybe they were at some kind of grand banquet luncheon at a hotel like this, I don't know. She said, "Would you make a contribution?" And Jessie Benton Fremont said, "I don't know that I want to do that. I think women manage men better as it is." But even she later changed her mind and made the contribution. The whole story of this country is a story of including more and more people. At the beginning, only a limited number of white men could vote. Then all white men could vote. Then African American men could vote. And then women can vote. And that has been the most profound development, one of the most profound developments in human history. And so however the heck we cover it, I hope we cover it well.
Our next question comes from Kay at table number 16. I know you do not have a crystal ball, but how do you picture America in 10 years?
Wow. I think I did say earlier I don't report on the future. I don't have good sources there. But I do have a sense of history. And so I would like to give a little bit of confidence. First, that we may well still be here. There are some people, I mean, in 2017, I interviewed a voter who was very upset about the election results. And he said, "Hell, I don't even know if we'll be alive in a year." More than a year has passed, we're still alive. It's okay. And so I'd like to voice some confidence that we'll still be here. I'd like to voice some confidence that our system that has withstood so much will withstand some more. I would like to voice some confidence that some of the enormous problems that we can't quite figure out how to face, perhaps we will have begun to face them. If we think about something really huge like climate change, we're not doing nearly enough, and yet technology is changing and industries are changing in ways that almost in spite of ourselves, we are beginning to address that problem. And we can hope, not know, because I'm not reporting the future, but we can hope that we will continue to move in that direction and perhaps move a little faster.
The We have time for one more question. This one comes from Beth over at table number 3. What was the most personally difficult story to cover and why?
The most personally difficult story to cover. I'm struggling to come up with a specific one, but I will say that anything having to do with children in peril is really difficult for me. Perhaps that's always been the case, but now that I'm a parent of 3 daughters, that is far, far more the case. It is really, really hard. It's really excruciating. Of course, my job is to try to pull some of my emotions out of it and be fair to whatever is happening or whatever anybody may be doing, but that's particularly hard. What is really hard about the job is also what is rewarding, which is connecting with human beings. And of course, sometimes people have terrible stories. And to be honest, it's not always a good thing when I call you up and ask you to tell me your story, because it may be that something really bad has happened to you. That's why I come to talk to you. And you hear these stories, and they do affect you over time, even though you want to hear them and you want to relate to that person. I'll mention one thing. It's not a story that I cover, but it's a difficulty that I have in hosting the program. Many of you are probably familiar with StoryCorps, the episode that comes on Friday, and you know, you'll have a mother talking to a daughter, a father talking to a daughter, a son, people talking about their mother who died. Unbelievable stories are told, and then that music comes up at the end and you cry, right? Does anybody here cry at the end of StoryCorps? Yes, many hands are going up. Well, my job is to listen to StoryCorps, and then that music comes up at the end, and then I'm supposed to talk. And there have been occasions when I've like choked up and had difficulty getting through a few words. And when that happens, I get an email from David Isay, old friend of mine who's the founder of StoryCorps, and the email will just say something like, "Gotcha." Now, I don't want to cry in front of you every week. It's okay if it happens once in a while, but I don't want to cry in front of you every week. And so, in recent years, what I've actually done is when StoryCorps is playing, I've got these headphones on, you see, turn the volume all the way down so that I just hear silence. And there's a director in the other room who'll give me a cue when to talk, and so I'll hear nothing. And then the cue will come, and I'll say, you know, that story will be archived at the Library of Congress. And sometimes, even then, not having heard the story, but knowing what it is, I'm still kind of struggling. So that's hard, but I think it's okay. It's the essence of what we do. It's the essence of what you support, which is a connection between human beings. Thank you very much.